I mean, Dickens is a great influence. She constantly acknowledges mm-hmm. Dickens. She constantly acknowledges the Dickens of Oliver Twist and Nicholas Nickleby.
Mm-hmm.
And she and what you've pointed out there is exactly right, which is to say, she reckons or she intuits that Dickens's novels, so Oliver Twist is a great example, that and you know the reception of Oliver Twist around the time, and the various non-literary performances of it attracted criticisms of excessive melodrama, right? The whole sort of Nancy's murder episode, etc., were accused precisely of stylistic excess. So what she intuits is, this is a great resource for me. And Dickens is writing about, essentially,
mm-hmm.
uneven, immiserated London. It's core, heart of empire, right? And for Eden, that's a great inspiration. She writes repeatedly about Dickens. Is there a stylistic correspondence between metropolitan and imperial writing? Absolutely, there is. So what, in other words, what I'm not trying to say is only people in India, only people in Ireland, only people in Africa are or can access this particular stylistic quirk. In other words, it appears everywhere where imperial and non-imperial capital. And it appears in weird, twisted ways that has specifics, obviously, but you can generalize it globally. She consciously says Dickens is a great influence. Stylistic, in other words. She thinks Dickens is a great moralist. With novels, of course, the whole kind of 1860s onwards, think of not just novels about India, but novels about the heart of Britain that will... Lady Audley's Secret, for instance, some of the idea that they've been written in melodramatic mode, but a melodramatic mode that exceeds the norms of those modes all the time. So, and they have their particular dynamics, they have their particular society and the environment and ecology that they reflect. But so does India, and that, coming back to Sari's earlier question, the link there is capitalism. That's why.
You framed your paper about the visual language of her text. Mm. Can you talk a bit about, it seems to me that there's a huge shift in the 19th century in terms of representations of the visual because of the rise of photography.
Yes.
So I was just wondering if you could talk a bit about the role of the picturesque as it exists in terms of ideas of sublime through painting, but then you have this rise of photography, particularly in the empire, right, which is about this kind of mimetic truth of
yeah.
the empire.
Right? Yeah.
It's the way these like images travel back to the motherland and,
yeah.
and represent the colonies. And I was just thinking, especially for the representations of the people who are starving, it's like this representation of lack, right? So there's a way that like the photograph is circulating as supposedly as evidence of what's in India,
mm.
right? And yet what you're seeing is actually the deprivation, which is a kind of representation of the lack of something, right? And in terms of food, people. So I just wondering if you could talk a bit about the shift between
mm.
the painting event, the kind of turn to photography that looks like this narrative, Eden's narrative, is engaging.
Mm. You know, so these are examples of Eden's own painting, right? This one and the earlier one. Now that is a kind of coming to Calcutta kind of painting, and that one is her whole book on what's called the Indian people and princes. She had a whole book on it. And you can do a kind of stylistic comparison between that and these two, which are later photographs, right? Of India. And it is very, and you point to a very interesting conundrum, that is, for photography, the claim is the real, right? This is what it is. As you say, the real then becomes a lack of what we think of the real, or what empire would say reality is. You can see bits of that coming through in journalism from the 1860s onwards. The bits I quoted about Digby, for instance. He is aiming very consciously for photographic realism. His entire account are really prose pictures that he doesn't provide a narrative, he just juxtaposes these. You know, here's the Darbar, here are the famine victims, here's the aristocrat, like the Raja, here's the person who's dying. Blah blah blah. It's a series of flick through photographs, basically, and he provides a bit of know, explanation from it, but not too much. So I guess the shift is registered at the level, the visual shift is also registered at the level of prose and non-visual cultural forms. In other words, the visual shift is significant, and it influences other cultural forms. This makes interesting reading for Eden, because the moment of composition, 1837 and 38, is pre-photography in India. And she, you know, she's famous really for these water painting, watercolors, and she has the tradition. I mean, there's a definite disjunction between her prose and her painting. There's nowhere in her painting that you will find the dying baby or the feminine stuff. That's what you'll find, and more usually that is what you'll find with the kind of typical sort of orientalist construction of the exotic Maharaj. That's what she paints about. What she writes about is startlingly different, and that disjunction doesn't come through. And she, it's interesting, her introduction is written in the 1860s, and it's far up to the book, and she stopped painting by that time. And post-1870s, of course, photography starts arriving 1882, 83, something like that in India. The first kind of, it's quite rapid, you know, it starts here, it starts there, kind of thing. And it would have been very interesting to see what Eden would have made of. But there's a definite disjunction between her writing and her painting. And that disjunction within Eden is much more widespread in general culture, imperial culture, later post-photography. So you're absolutely right in what the effect of photography on photographic realism or whatever it is in imperial writing. I mean, Kipling is a great example of that kind of sudden weird mixture of vivid photographic realism and total fantasy, that the imperial Gothic. And then becomes a different animal.
Do you have any further questions? We have a reception, we have some food, some wine. People want to ask a couple of questions on a formal basis. I welcome you to it now. Please join me in thanking.
Well, thank you. Great questions, and I'll have to think about a lot of what you said before I write another line, which is a good thing.